today on the Scott Thompson Show on 900 CHML.
All right. You might remember last week we were talking with Paul Delaney, space exploration expert, professor of astronomy and physics at York University, about Perseverance, another rover landing on Mars, an incredible feat of science to see how this all happens. But now we are seeing incredible pictures that are coming back of this whole descent and landing and such. Let's bring in Paul Delaney now from York University. Paul, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am indeed, Scott. Thanks for the call.
So I watched a piece of this video today, and I think the first thing, and you probably know what I'm going to say, I think the first thing that stands out for me is I remember being a little kid and the neighbors calling us in to watch the moon landing and to actually see the astronauts in the capsule and all that other stuff and that greeny kind of video that we saw. And man, looking at these shots of Perseverance, it's like you can read the serial numbers off the side of the thing. The quality of the images is just spectacular.
As different as cheese and chalk. Absolutely. I too remember, the Apollo 11 and squinting at the screen, and that's the best expression I can use, squinting at the screen to see the details. Yet the imagery that NASA released yesterday of the descent process for Perseverance, talk about high definition. You're right there. I could feel myself swaying on the harness, and, it was just beautiful. Nothing compared to it. In recent years, the imagery that they were able to capture during the descent this time round, second to none, and it really gave you the impression that you were right there with the rover.
I thought it was fascinating when it started to approach the actual surface of Mars once you started to see the dust kick up.
That's right, exactly. The eight engines that were holding the sky crane in place, the descent section, really did kick up quite a bit of dust. And you could literally see Perseverance lowered into a dust storm. I mean, there's great poetry associated with the whole affair, no question. We've seen some imagery before, stills here and there, some from orbit. I like the parachute canopy being from orbit and so on. But the imagery they picked up this time, they went to special lengths to ensure that they could see the parachute deploy, the perspective of the ground from the lander, and then, as the sky crane was engaging, the down and up looking perspective. As I said, they spared no effort this time around to ensure we all had a ringside seat. And we got it back literally, within 3 days. I mean, there's a lot of bandwidth there coming from Mars, and the imagery was well worth the wait.
Talk about that, because even the science, we know how far away this planet is. And again, it takes minutes for a signal to go from point A to point B. But as you said, the bandwidth, we all know what it's like working, at home and having issues with computers and such and taxing the system. The fact that they can transport those images from one point to another, in that clarity is just unbelievable.
They've put into orbit around Mars relay mechanisms that, even Elon Musk could probably be drooling with. We've got satellites in orbit around Mars. They've been there, some of them for as long as sort of 17, 18 years, some much more recent. But all of them have had this redundant capability to support land operations. And it was really utilized very well this time. I think NASA had three of its own satellites picking up transmissions in the event, of course, that something happened, you wanted this level of redundancy. But, picking up all of the transmissions, the Perseverance itself had a dedicated system independent of, monitoring its own health, but, just worrying about the photography of it. Then, of course, we've got the sound as well now. I mean, there was just a lot of attention to detail utilizing all of the assets that were in orbit around Mars. So it's been a very comprehensive use of those assets that NASA has been able to employ, and you and I are the beneficiaries of it. It really is superb.
That's exactly what I was about to say here, Paul, is that, you know, we often talk about the costs associated with doing this, and lots of people are saying, why are we wasting our money doing that when we have issues here on Earth? But the technology involved, and just for example, these images, you're going to see that sooner or later in your own, whether it's device or what have you, in a few years. It's amazing how that comes back to serve us.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's why various nations are putting time, effort, and energy into space-based applications, because it employs people that stay in the country. The technology that they develop ends up in yours and I's pockets with cell phones and iPads and so on and so forth. It's not a closed environment. We're not just going to Mars for the sake of, you know, a few science and engineering
nerds. Right.
I mean, this is really something that benefits us all in one way or another. And to me, that's the unsung story of what NASA did last week. You know, they're making it a point of showing us this detail to make us excited to really engage in the exploration process. But it's also a polite little nod to saying, you know, these are the people we're training, and you know what? They're going to be working for, you know, pick your organization in the coming months and years. And you, as the public, will be the beneficiary of it.
Yeah, and again, as we mentioned, those pictures from Apollo compared to what we're seeing now, I mean, the Apollo almost looked like ultrasound. They almost look like ultrasound pictures. It's amazing just to
we
see how that's...
We've come a long way in 50 years. I mean,
yeah, boy, have we.
Yeah, no offense to the Apollo era, but yeah, it really was another lifetime ago.
So we hear often of that 7 minutes of terror. Explain to people what that is.
So as the spacecraft is approaching Mars, it's on literally a ballistic trajectory. It doesn't stop and go into orbit. It is traveling in its cruise phase at about 20,000 kilometers an hour. It's sort of, you know, booting along there, and it hits the top of the atmosphere, traveling with all of this energy, with all of this speed. It's got to wash that energy away and get to the ground at a nice leisurely 0 kilometers an hour, and it's got to do that in 7 minutes. That's how long it takes because of the speed it's traveling at. And so it hits the atmosphere, the probe hits the atmosphere, washes a lot of that speed and energy off in terms of friction. So that's the heat of reentry. The heat shield takes most of that. The vehicle is banking through the atmosphere, sort of trying to bleed off as much energy, contacting as much air as it can. And then it deploys the parachute once it gets to around 1,000 kilometers an hour. It's still traveling, you know, very, very fast. But 1,000 kilometers an hour, the parachute deploys, and you can see the parachute deploy in the imagery. It takes less than a second to go and deploy itself. I mean, it's a piece of engineering technology just there, which is quite amazing.
Well, yeah, then, right. Like, stop right there, Paul. Right. You think about that, how fast this thing is going, and then it drags out a parachute. Like, how does it just not end up like a torn sheet in the air?
For the first several years of development of these parachutes, that's exactly what happened. I mean, this was a long process, and I remember following along while NASA was developing this process. They were doing it first in wind tunnels because, of course, you can't generate that necessary speed in regular air deploy. So they're doing it in wind tunnel tests, and the vast majority of the parachutes just shredded mercilessly at those speeds. But they eventually figured it out, and now they do it routinely. So, you know, the parachute's out. The spacecraft is now gently wafting towards the ground. They get rid of what they call the back shell, and now Perseverance begins to look at the ground, and it's got like about 2 minutes to figure out exactly where it is based upon the land markings, decide whether or not it's on course, whether or not it needs to make any corrections, and then identify a safe landing spot. You can't put this on a boulder or a rock or, you know, an outcropping that's going to puncture. You know, remember, Ingenuity is on the base of this rover, so you can't put it down on top of a rock outcropping. And so it's got 2 minutes to do that. It finally concludes, yep, I know where I'm going. We're on track. It then gets rid of the parachute, and now the 8 thrusters fire up and bring it to a hovering position above the ground. And as you said, you could see the dust being kicked up by those thrusters. And then, you know, 20-meter winch for the spacecraft down to the ground. I mean, that's the 7 minutes of terror. And it's all done on autopilot. You know, we are so far from Earth, you mentioned this, you know, light travel time is just too long. The spacecraft has got to do all of its own thinking, the programming, the contingencies. Imagine if your blue screen of death crops up, right? You've got to reboot your system in the middle of 7 minutes of terror. I mean, there is no fingernails left at mission control during this sequence. And you saw the release of that pent-up tension when the call came out, Tango Bravo, that, you know, it's touched down on the surface of Mars. It was great.
And there, the celebration you see afterwards, you can imagine. Paul Delaney, space exploration expert, professor of astronomy and physics, York University. Great pictures coming back from Perseverance that is up there roaming around on Mars. Paul, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well. Take care.
My pleasure, Scott. Take care.
You're listening to the Scott Thompson Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We were talking just the other day about the investigation into the engine failure of a Boeing 777. Obviously, the engine coming apart in air. I believe Denver to Hawaii was the flight of the United Airlines. And obviously, the engine had a catastrophic failure. We're now already finding preliminary, the investigators, rather, have released a preliminary finding on the engine failure. And to talk more about that, let's bring in Keith Mackey, aviation expert and owner-operator of Mackey International. Did we just lose Keith? Oh. All right, go ahead. So you might remember what happened. We're just trying to get Keith back on the line. So you might remember this was a airline that was flying over out of Denver on its way to Hawaii. A couple of minutes into the flight, all of a sudden, a massive engine failure. The engine blows apart, flames out. Pieces of the engine fly off the cowling in the areas that cover the engine. Leaving the plane and actually landing in people's yards and such below. Luckily, nobody was hurt on the plane or on the ground as a result of the flying parts. But from what they have discovered already, it looks like they do have some indication as to what's happened. Let's bring in Keith Mackey, aviation expert, owner and operator of Mackey International, and is with us now. Keith, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, Scott, and yourself?
Good. Thanks for taking the time for a quick update here, Keith. I was surprised that, or were you surprised, that how quickly they've, again, these are preliminary findings, but they seem to know what happened here.
It didn't take very long to figure out that one of the fan blades had departed. Quick look at the engine would have told. In fact, we really suspected that yesterday because as we looked at the video, we could see the fan section vibrating quite a bit, and we could notice that there was one area where there appeared to be a missing blade.
They say metal fatigue, the reason here. How do you monitor that? How do you make sure this doesn't happen?
Well, let's go through how these jet engines are developed and put into service. When a new engine's developed, they put time limits on everything. You can fly so many hours, and then you have to take it apart and overhaul it and inspect everything. And as the engines acquire more service experience in the fleet, that time is raised and raised and raised. And eventually, let's just say an airline has 50 of an engine type, and they've run them all a million hours and never had any trouble at all. The FAA will make the part on condition. In other words, as long as the engine is developing the proper power, you don't have to take it apart and inspect every little piece. And this engine, a couple of years ago, had done already 150 million engine hours. So it's an engine that's been around for a long time. There's a lot of experience with it. And this situation is not exactly unique. Seems that back in 2018, another United 777 going into Honolulu, of all places, the same as this one, this time out of San Francisco, on descent, about 45 minutes out, had exactly the same thing happen. The NTSB final report noted that the primary cause was lapses and failures in Pratt & Whitney's fan blade inspections, resulting in a cracked blade erroneously being returned to service. An inspector had seen a possible sign of a crack in the blade. He thought it was just paint. He put it back on the engine, and apparently it ran several years before it actually failed. So this is not unique. The reason it's getting so much attention is because it came apart over a residential neighborhood. We really haven't heard about the other one because it apparently came apart over the ocean and didn't put anybody in any danger. So at any rate, what they'll do is they'll look at these blades that failed. And I think one failed and possibly took out another one. And they'll look at the metal microscopically, see what caused the failure, if it had been pre-existing, if it had been something that damaged that blade in particular. And they'll get it resolved quite quickly, I think. These fan blades can be changed rather easily. Remember, this is the front part of the engine, the part that rotates right in the very front. So it gets all the erosion from sand and anything that goes through the engine wears out those fan blades. So they're inspected rather frequently, and if one has gotten some damage, it's relatively easy to change the blades individually. So I'm sure that the failure will go along those lines. Hopefully it's just isolated to one blade. Hopefully there was something unique about that blade that caused the failure that won't affect a number of them. But time will tell. I don't think it'll take a great deal of time.
You said that these engines, some are aging or certainly have a lot of hours on them. Will this result in a change in inspection protocol? What do you think is going to come out of this incident?
Well, I think it will. I think that we'll likely find that perhaps this thing could have been spotted if it had been inspected properly. Perhaps we'll find that someone failed to do their job when they did inspect it. Perhaps we'll find that there's some sort of a defect, but I think that's kind of remote as far as a design defect, because these things have so many, many, many millions of hours on them. They run on the 747 uses the same engine, the A300, the 767. It's a very popular engine, so there's many, many of them out there in the fleet.
How dangerous is it when one of these comes apart? It appeared that a piece of it even punctured the fuselage.
Well, remember, this engine, this is the compressor section of the engine, and it's spinning very fast, particularly in this situation when it's operating at high power out of a high elevation airport such as Denver. They probably are running at their max power, so it's under the most strain at that point. And if anything happens to one of those fan blades, these have a fair amount of mass, and it broke off apparently at the root of the blade. And it'd be kind of like driving down the highway at 80 miles an hour in your car with a big balance weight on the wheel, and that suddenly flings off. Suddenly you're going to get a lot of vibration in your steering and shaking, and that's what happened here. It shook so much that it dislodged the cowling, which caused it all to fall down in that residential neighborhood. So I think that the problem will be solved relatively easily. There's just too many of these engines out there, and there's too much experience with these parts to have some basic design flaw, I think.
Keith Mackey's been with us, aviation expert and owner-operator of Mackey International. Already preliminary findings on what happened with that United Airlines flight and its engine failure on the Boeing 777, and it looks like they're on their way to correcting that. Keith, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You're welcome, Scott. You too. Thank you.
The Scott Thompson Show, weekdays from noon to 3 on 900 CHML.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.